From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is Dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Doctor, better at social than I am, Pope.
This is yet to be seen,
okay,
Dan.
Okay. So there's an eye test, and they just show you a pairs of eyes over and over and over, and there are different emotions in the eyes. So like they might be squinty or wide-eyed, and your job is to guess what emotion this is. And so I did this, and Denise did this, and I really am quite proud at how good I can read people's emotions.
And I think I'm better than you, right? Like when we had this conversation, you said, I need you to do the test. And, and Dan and I are a little competitive. You might not have picked up on that. But I thought, gosh, I'm better at reading people's faces than Dan maybe. And I think we're both good because we're educators. But, well, no, because educators are supposed, you know, you're supposed to be able to relate to your student and kind of figure out, oh, this is not going to go well or whatever. But the thing that was so hard for me is that it was just the eyes. It was literally just the eyes. And I realized that I rely on a lot of other cues.
Oh, I look at the mouth.
I look at the mouth for sure. I look at the whole face. I'll listen even to tone.
So does this mean you got a low score?
I got a low score.
What is it? There's 20 questions?
Oh, I don't remember my raw score. I just remember the percentage.
What's your percentage?
64%.
So, Denise?
I mean, 64%. No, I'm better than 64% of the people.
Yeah.
So it was like a 28 or something.
So that's really good.
Come on.
It is. I was better than like 15% of the people. I was really bad at it. I was terrible at it.
Okay, first of all, I'm feeling a little bit good here.
And the consequence is every girlfriend I have ever had says, see, see.
Well, no, I thought it was really hard. I went in there very cocky. I'm like, I can do this, and I can certainly beat Dan. But I was like, wait, this is really hard.
It is hard. I think it's
just
unfair.
The eyes. I'm going to just call it right now a bogus test. Sorry for the people who are doing it. People use more than the eyes.
Sorry. Enjoy your victory.
Okay.
It's a good test.
I'm actually really proud
Let me switch it.
Okay.
Do you think your face has tells? Like if I were to play poker with you, would I know when you've got a good hand and stuff?
I'm a pretty good actress is what I've been told because I can fake. No, if I'm really mad at someone, but I have to be civil, I can be as opposed to my husband who there's no way.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Like he can't hide his emotions in that way.
Oh, interesting.
So I can do it a little bit. What about you?
So I think my face has a lot of tells, but other people's interpretation is always wrong.
What do you mean?
Well, they see my face, so I have to say things like, I'm not angry, I'm concentrating.
Oh.
So they're reading my face quite well. It's just they've got the wrong signal.
Yeah. I've got one of my kids, she's going to get mad that I'm saying this, but one of my kids, when her face is at rest, it kind of looks like she's mad or angry. We tease her about that.
Yeah.
But she's not. She's a very happy person. Actually,
there's nothing, no surgery or anything.
We're not at that point.
Okay.
So how does this all relate?
Yeah. Well, because we have one of the world's experts on studying autism. And so I'm happy to welcome Dennis Wall, who's a professor of pediatrics at Stanford in the School of Medicine. And his lab studies autism and then develops these innovative tools for kids and families, which will be mind blowing. And to better understand development and behavior and to help people. So welcome, Dennis.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're happy to have you. And I'm assuming you're going to say how looking at people's eyes relates to the topic. People might not have made that connection.
Dennis, help, help.
Well, children with autism, which has become a very pervasive condition now, it's really a public health epidemic at this point. 1 in 40 kids in the United States impacted today. These kids unanimously struggle to make face contact and understand what's going on in faces, make eye contact, engage in the social world. And so they often struggle to differentiate what's going on in the face, what's different from a happy and angry, a surprised face. And they have to be taught.
Do we know why? Or is this just one of many?
We really don't know the cause of that specific deficit, but we do know it's fixable. We do know that it can be addressed. We do know that we can teach these children to engage in their social worlds and learn more about the facial expressions and the variations in them, why they're interesting, why faces are interesting inherently. What they do is they tend to gravitate towards antisocial things. They'll focus on other things in the room, you know, be it trains or, you know, play cars or even just like screwdrivers and things like that. And they'll just finger these things kind of, you know, fidgety and in a way that's a little bit like obsessive compulsion. And what we try to do is pull them out of that antisocial world and have them engage with their social.
Is it antisocial? I mean, are they avoiding social, or are these objects very attractive because they have regular patterns?
They seem to be very attractive because they have regular patterns. It's not so much an avoidance thing. It's a thing that they tend to prefer. It's really a preference and choice thing. As far as we can tell.
Can you define autism? I think people might think of autism as a kid who doesn't speak at all and who kind of maybe flaps his arms or something. And then there's people who hear of this thing called the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. Can you just put that all into...
Sure. It is very much a spectrum. This is true, of course, for many human conditions that ranges from very mild severity to very high severity, where the high severity kids are typically nonverbal and have life course conditions and comorbidities that require care 24/7 in some cases. Institutionalization, they potentially have some seizures and self-mutilization, things of that nature. Medium severity kids will struggle kind of for much of their lives with social interactions, but can work through them in ways that are, you know, taught and learned over time. And the mild severity kids are very reachable in many ways through educational programs. And these kids really just struggle with certain elements of social. And typically these are understanding emotional differences in faces, making face contact, engaging that social world. And by and large, the rise in the incidence that we've seen over the last, say, 10 years or so, which has been over 600%, by the way, is in large part due to this more mild severity form of autism.
Is this an increase because we've gotten better at diagnosing, or do people really think it's increasing?
Well, the rise itself is probably difficult to justify through just recognition alone. Mm-hmm. If you think about the math,
because that's so high, yeah,
exactly. And so there's almost, yes, in part it's due to recognition, better diagnostic procedures, more frequency of recognition by the general population of people who can practice the art of diagnosis, general pediatricians, developmental specialists, and so forth. But it's also due, for sure, to something else. In this case, an environmental contribution. I can tell you a little bit about that if you're interested, but
I am, but not at this moment. Just to continue understanding, is there a genetic component to autism?
Yes. In fact, the concordance between identical twins can be as high as 90%. So that's a strong indicator of genetics playing a role.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are talking with Dr. Dennis Wall about autism, causes, what it looks like. Fascinating. And it may be that you don't even know that a kid in your class has autism. It might be that they're so well-functioning that you might not know that as a teacher. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what does it look like at sort of the high-functioning level if you are a teacher in your classroom? Would there be differences?
There'll be differences. There'll be difficulties in understanding changes in social scenarios, for example, or really just recognizing a variation in emotion that is exhibited even by your peer, let's say, in a fifth-grade classroom. If you've seen like the movie The Polar Express, for example, there's a child in that who has an archetype that's typical sort of mild, medium severity autism, just a little bit different, and sort of pushing their way through a social scenario without recognizing kind of what the impacts are when they're behaving.
Hmm. So you're working on this.
We're working on it.
Yeah. So tell us about some of your innovations.
So we have a few, and we're trying to address some key issues in the healthcare system. There's two particularly acute bottlenecks in the healthcare system that we've been trying to address. One is with our ability to diagnose autism, and the other is with our ability to treat autism. Both are limited by the number of clinical care practitioners who can perform those two things, diagnostic practices and delivery of behavioral therapy. It's really a simple mathematical imbalance between the number of kids in need and number of people who can provide the care. And it's not likely to go away, especially with the incidence rising the way it has. And so on the diagnostic side, we've built methods that mobilize to the homes of the families to enable home video and machine learning assisted diagnosis at the point of care, really, in real time. And on the other side, on the therapeutic delivery systems, because we care greatly about not just diagnosing, but and diagnosing earlier. So the average age of diagnosis in the United States right now is 4.5, and we want to drive that down to maybe 2-3 years of age, which I think we can do confidently.
Because more plasticity?
Because we can push it into a mobile platform and literally just enable mobile uploads of videos into a cloud system that does AI on it and delivers an outcome, a probability score.
My question was, earlier diagnosis is good?
It's good, yes. And the reason why is because the earlier you can start to intervene, the higher the likelihood that the child will progress in a very positive way. So they're walking, I'm sure you're educators, you know this, they're going through windows of brain developmental plasticity where early training is critical. And as I said earlier, they gravitate towards things that are not social. And so they're not intuitively picking up on different cues that are happening in the faces of individuals with whom they're supposed to be interacting. But if we can push them in that direction, which is what we've been focusing on, in a friendly and engaging way, at the home, in the moments of care where they need to have it happen, like when they're in their natural social scenarios, we can win. We can actually affect enormous changes to the point even where kids will progress off the spectrum, no longer qualify for a diagnosis.
Wait, you can progress off the spectrum? That's a thing?
That's a thing.
That's incredible. I did not know that.
That's a thing.
That's really hopeful.
So it is a continuous variable, right? And it's a phenotype that has adjustments and changes over time, just like anything else. It's the developmental trajectory that it takes. And if you intervene early enough, no one really knows exactly what the right windows are, but we believe it's definitely between 3, 4, and 8 years of age, then many of these, especially mild, medium severity kids, will no longer fit the criteria for a diagnosis.
So the machine learning is looking at videos.
Who's looking at the kids looking at the video?
On the diagnostic side, we have AI operating on videos of the child at risk. And
what are the cues they're picking? Do you know the cues they're picking up?
We do. We actually developed supervised models that were trained against the outcome from the administrations of the standard of care. So, which, by the way, takes a long time to practice, but it gets deposited into medical records to which we can gather and to which we can gain access, and we can perform. And these are categorical ordinal measurements, hundreds of them, made on kids when they're assessing the likelihood of risk and ultimately diagnosing autism over sometimes 2 days of clinical evaluations in a clinical setting. We've been able to mine those records to prioritize the features of interest, essentially, and then figure out how to measure those features of interest in the videos themselves. And so the features are things like intonation, prosody, tone, rhythm, functional play with toys, social smiling, joint attention, things of that nature. So if I look over, point to a thing, that's joint attention or social smiling, I smile, you smile, that sort of thing.
So the video is of kind of a stage diagnosis, and the AI is just helping the clinician, as opposed to having a video of the kid at home.
The video would be taken in the natural setting, and then uploaded and evaluated through this artificial intelligence process. And the score can then be used by the clinician to make a decision.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Dr. Dennis Wall about autism and particularly what he and his lab have developed to help kids. So tell a little bit more about the intervention.
Yes. So assuming for a moment that we've been able to figure out how we can mobilize and create great economies of scale for detection and diagnosis of autism, we don't want to create another bottleneck, or even worse, bottleneck on the other side and access to therapy. Therapy, like diagnosis, is limited by the availability of clinical practitioners, but also limited in terms of its generalizability to the natural settings and scenarios that the kids need to be in. And finally, also limited in part by the quality of care, heterogeneity in the quality of care that's delivered across applied behavioral technicians. These are the individuals who are trained at the art of teaching kids how to work with their autism, essentially. What they do is they use flashcards. They typically use flashcards that have human faces statically depicted, emoting something like happy, sad, surprised.
Faces, not just eyes.
That's what I was just going to say.
Not just eyes.
Faces.
Full faces.
You can't just do the eyes. It's way too hard.
You won, Denise. Let it go.
I want to just point out, it is not fair. It is the full face. It is the full face that you need.
It is the full face.
Okay.
And they're actors, of course, expressing these emotions. But as you can imagine, while effective, and by the way, very effective, especially if delivered early in those windows I talked about, 4 to 8, for example, can only capture so much of the natural variation that exists in the human face, right? So flashcards are flashcards. They're static. They're not dynamic. And so, you know, for example, if the bearded, if the angry man is bearded, you know, there's a the potential for maladaptive association between beardedness and angriness. So kids will say, oh, that's an angry person. But no, it's not. It's just a guy who has a beard.
Oh, interesting.
And so we want it, but also because of the rate limitations and scalability of this one-to-one relationship clinician to child, we wanted to create an alternative vehicle through which we could deliver the same forms of powerful behavioral training, but in a way that's natural and that's continuous, operating in the homes of families. And so for that, we for reasons related to the student that I was working with at the time, Cataline Voss, and my postdoc, Nick Haber, who had already started playing around with Google Glasses, we decided to start there. It's an augmented reality. It's a wearable. It has a peripheral monitor that sits off to the right side of your in the peripheral vision of your right eye.
So like in the corner of the glass sort of has
a little
like
monitor.
A TV screen. Yeah.
And it's quite small, and it's easy to, you know, after a short period of time to acclimate to and almost ignore. So it has a lot of the facets that we thought were good: hands-free, wearable, augmented, not virtual or mixed reality. So we're not taking the kids out of their natural worlds or leaving them in it. And so we decided to utilize that as the form factor to go ahead with a computer vision AI system to teach the child from their point of view, egocentric point of view, what's going on in the world around them, with respect to faces and with respect to emotions in those faces.
So the AI is also looking through the class with the kid, and
yes.
Then it is able to put a cue in the monitor in the corner of the glass to help the kid know what it is.
That's right.
It's fabulous.
It puts a face in, so like you see, and then it puts a little face in, like a happy face saying like that person is happy?
It does two things. First, so we have computer vision technology that finds faces and tracks them. Hard to do, and took time to develop, but in a way that would be appropriate for the natural settings of the child. So they're in their homes, they're working with their peers or their parents or whatever it is, uncles, aunts, grandparents, and so on, natural social interactors. That face tracker, face finder, puts a green box in the peripheral monitor. So it basically outlines the monitor to say to the child, good job, you found a face. And then immediately thereafter, it submits an emoji or emoticon that tells the child it's a happy face.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Dr. Dennis Wall talking about autism and things to look for next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Dr. Dennis Wall, who is an expert on autism and who has done some really cool interventions around helping kids recognize facial expression.
So this is incredibly cool technology. And so I do like education technology. And so I immediately start thinking, how could I use this for other stuff? So there are studies that look at if young children pay attention to quantity, and you can see, do they look?
What do you mean quantity? Like what?
So I have a puppet, and I feed it 3 candies in the mouth of the puppet.
Okay.
And then I say to you, do the same thing I did.
Okay.
And the question is, you as a child, do you just give candies or do you give exactly 3?
Oh.
And kids who are doing earlier are actually doing the 3 end up having a better progression into math. So I could use this class for this, right? To get these kids to orient towards quantity.
Interesting.
And then make a series of games where the specific numbers matter.
And the games seem to be, I know Dan loves games and has a lot of really good stuff out there that he's found with gaming and learning. And it sounds like you've got another game as well. So you make it fun for the kids to learn how to copy emotions.
Right. So far it's been receptive. You must have something for productive for them to produce.
Right. So we actually have this game called Guess What, which is inspired by the popular game Heads Up, which was, I think, co-developed by Ellen DeGeneres. But
totally fun party game.
It's a fun party game. And our game is very similar. You put the phone on the forehead and something pops up on the screen that's age appropriate and developmental level appropriate. For example, it could just be emojis. And the child's job at that point, the mom, by the way, in this scenario, is holding the phone on her forehead. The child's job is to act out what's on the screen. And if successful, the mom can guess and pass to the next prompt. We can record the video. We can understand from the child's perspective if their imitations are improving and if those imitations are starting to support stronger levels of social understanding, social acuity.
It's really good.
I love that the mom gets to guess. That it's not because the other one is the kid kind of guessing.
Right. So the mom's holding a picture on her forehead.
Yeah.
And it's an emoji that is like happy. Right. And then the kid has to act it out. This is like a diagnosis for early actors.
Yeah.
We could, at age of three, we can see.
Are you going to go to Broadway or not? So I know as a mom, I know there's folks out there kind of thinking, well, how do I know when my 1 or 2 year old, because that seems really early, but you want early detection. What are some things I should be looking for in my 1 or 2 year old?
It's a great question. In particular, in the 2 year olds, where there's instances of early signs for autism, you're going to see things like toe walking.
Say what that means.
So, like,
you're standing on your
tiptoes. Sort of standing on their toes in some sort of circular motions. So there's a physical sort of dance morphology, in a sense, that can happen.
Okay.
There'll be a clear focus on some non-social distractors, for example. In my own experiences, I've seen kids, if there's a screw that's like stuck in the crevice of a door, for example, they find it and they finger it continuously. And they won't come out of that world.
Okay.
Response to name is another thing.
Like
lack
when you
of
call
respond
them,
to
they
call and call and call, and they simply do not respond.
Uh-huh.
Those are very clear signs and indicators.
That's super helpful. And then they should go to their pediatrician and relay their concerns.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Hand flapping is another one, by the way. Just this fluttery hand flapping behavior, which you'll see quite a bit in early development.
And it doesn't mean to panic. It doesn't mean, oh my gosh. It's just go tell your doctor that you saw these things, because now there's interventions out
there.
That's right. And for a teacher, because they're going to be a little bit older, they'll be 5, 6, 7 year olds in your classroom. Antisocial behavior, is that what you're looking for? I guess flapping. I remember seeing flapping in classrooms.
Right, flapping for sure it will continue to persist, and some fidgety behaviors like wringing of the hands or pulling back of the fingers and things like that that'll be common among children. This might be a sort of a symptom associated with managing anxiety. We're not entirely clear, but it's persistent and pretty pronounced in some cases.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Dr. Dennis Wall about signs to look for if your child may be showing signs of being on the autism spectrum disorder.
So let me switch the questions a little bit. So there was a famous expert in autism, and he was giving a speech, and his sort of, if I can remember it right, his argument was, why do you want to make them more social? They don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So do you get pushback where it's sort of, this is what my child is. I should make a world in which this child thrives.
We haven't received any explicit pushback on it. I think my sort of counterpoint to that is essentially that our goals with, let's say, the Google Glass program, the superpower glasses, and with our Guess What program is to foster understanding and appreciation of the social world during windows where even typically developing kids need to understand the variation in human faces. It's not like my son immediately understood when I went from happy to angry. He had to learn, and he did so organically on his own. And I think when the children are learning these things, it just creates social confidence. It creates opportunities for them that sustain them for longer periods of time in more complex scenarios. And so in some ways, we think of it as bridging them to a world, to bridging them to a place where they can make decisions, right, about how they want to engage and when they want to engage. And that's really it. And so they may choose ultimately to stay in a sort of a non-social environment, but at least they have the skill sets to make those decisions.
Well, and I know, and this is probably totally unfair, but there are sort of joking that Silicon Valley and engineers and computer scientists are sort of on the spectrum, and I have no idea if that's true or not, but what people say is because, you know, you spend long periods of time in front of a computer alone, it may seem like a good career for someone who is, you know, prone to attention of that kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's, I think, very healthy and fulfilling a career and opportunity for adolescents and adults who are on the spectrum now, and they tend to be in areas like that where they're able to focus their ability to hyper-focus, in a sense, on things that are incredibly productive, coding or unit testing, design, things of that nature.
And I know we have a friend who has a kid who is on the spectrum. Is that the right way to say it? You say mm-hmm. you're on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And he is fixated on airplanes and always needs to know, like, what was the, you know, were you on a 747, Denise? Mm-hmm. And tell me all about it. And he, like, it's almost like he's really, really advanced and kind of genius level in that one narrow area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that a common?
That's common.
And it's not just transportation, because you guys were talking about trains and cars.
It's could because
be anything.
It's what they think about.
Yeah, it's what they
and
think
so
about.
So you get expertise.
Exactly, yeah. And so what we try to do with the interventions is catch that kind of hyper-focused attention early and sort of like pivot it towards things that can help them, again, build that social confidence and have a appreciation for the variation that exists in the social world and make decisions at that point. Maybe they're not going to continue to stay focused on the variation and channel in on one specific thing, but again, they know that the variation exists. So we talk about it as like appreciation for the salience of emotion. You know, that there's something interesting in faces.
I love that there's so much being done, and there's so much of technology work and smart people like Dr. Wall who can do this. So it's pretty exciting.
I completely agree. It is, it's a little mind-blowing.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Did you want to say
one last thing? Is that parents of children with autism can play a very significant part in the training and education of their child. And I think these kinds of tools like Glass, Google Glass, and guess what, these games, but there are many others, can assist in that process.
That's wonderful.
Thank you so much, and thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes, and on SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.